Chapter 10, Revolt Against the Modern World and the Mystery of the Grail. After the mask and face of contemporary spiritualism, I wrote what is, perhaps, my most important work, Revolt Against the Modern World. A first edition of the book was published by Hoepli in 1934, and a second by Bocca in 1951, and a third by Edizioni Mediterranei in 1970. The title of the work is not reflective of its content, for Revolt is not a polemical pamphlet, polemics and, quote, revolt, unquote, rather following implicitly as consequences, but a study of the morphology of civilization and history. The starting point of the book is a denunciation of the regressive character of the modern world and of modern civilization. What distinguishes my own denunciation in Revolt from that of other authors, both past and present, who voiced similar ideas, often invoking some kind of reaction or reconstruction, is my specific attempt to provide a broader perspective and to emphasize those points of reference which contribute to shed light on the true nature of the modern world and the extent of its crisis. With the exception of Guinan, all authors of some renown who discussed similar matters in recent times, not to mention all those, quote, protesting, unquote, youths inspired by Herbert Marcuse, lacked any such frame of reference. Firstly, in Revolt, I emphasized how all those ideological tendencies that arose from the ingenuous optimism of the Age of Progress, which now constitute a cause for alarm and have been made the object of various reactions, are simply the product of the final phase in a vast process of general devolution. Most of the aforementioned contemporary authors have shown themselves to be unaware of the previous phases in this degenerative process, which they actually regard as positive steps and, quote, achievements, unquote. I hear remarked that, quote, one is often sick for a long time with an illness that only clearly breaks out after it has wrought its damage, unquote. In order to define the various stages in this process of devolution and explain their interconnection, I resorted less to my own explanations than to traditional doctrines, which I explored and adapted. In particular, I referred to the doctrine of four ages and to that of caste regression. My analysis of the modern world was articulated by means of a definition of its opposite, the, quote, world of tradition, unquote, where the word, quote, tradition, unquote, is to be understood in the sense I previously described. Historical circumstances aside, in morphological terms, I defined the, quote, modern world, unquote, and the, quote, world of tradition, unquote, as, quote, two general a priori categories of civilization, unquote, a description which applies equally well to the notions of, quote, modern world, unquote, and of, quote, man of tradition, unquote. In contrast to Spengler, I spoke of civilizations not in terms of plurality, or less still, of relativity, but of duality. I also emphasized the consistency of traditional civilizations, all aspects of which are essentially linked to underlying principles. The first section of Revolt provides, quote, an approach to the categories of the traditional spirit, unquote. I here outlined, quote, the underlying principles in the life of the man of tradition, unquote. I explained that, quote, the term category is here used to describe any a priori normative principle. Specific forms and meanings, therefore, ought not to be regarded as separate objects, but rather as ideas which determine and shape reality in life, and which possess a value in themselves insofar as their concrete embodiment, something necessarily far from perfect, can be determined, unquote. In other words, what I sought to examine here were basic ideals, either implicitly or explicitly expressed in given historical circumstances, ideals of a normative and superhistorical character. By the use of comparisons, I sought to elucidate or supplement various examples, an operation not unlike the mathematical passage from differential to integral calculus. I identified the foundation of the world of tradition with the doctrine of two natures, a doctrine based on the notion of the existence of two opposing orders, a physical order and a metaphysical. The latter order represents the superior realm of, quote, being, unquote, opposed to the lower realm of becoming and of history, an immortal nature opposed to the perishable. The man of tradition does not perceive this doctrine as merely a, quote, theory, unquote, but rather as a directly verifiable existential truth. Each traditional civilization is thus characterized by an attempt to lead man from the lower order of reality to the higher, along various stages of approximation, participation, and effective realization. Originally, at the center of each traditional civilization stood, quote, immanent transcendence, unquote, the concrete presence of a non-human transcendent force embodied in higher beings possessing the highest authority. Perhaps the chief expressions of this idea are ancient forms of divine kingship. The most common means of passing from the lower nature to the higher has always been initiation. Contemplation and heroic action represent two great paths based on an approximation to the higher order, loyalty and ritual, two means of sharing in such an order. The higher order of reality has always found a support in traditional law, with its objective and superpersonal character, and has symbolically been expressed by the traditional state or empire, a worldly and historical reflection of that which transcends the world. Such, then, are the foundations of traditional hierarchies and civilizations. In the first section of Revolt, on the basis of a comparative and integrative study of data gathered from a number of written ancient sources, both Eastern and Western, I defined the aforementioned concepts as the, quote, constants, unquote, or, quote, unchanging factors, unquote, of the world of tradition. I further outlined the traditional understanding of issues such as jurisprudence and law, ritual, war and victory, property, space and time, art and games, the relation between the warrior caste and the priestly caste, the relation between the sexes, race, ascesis, the afterlife, and immortality. These many and diverse issues, I emphasized, were all underlined by a single spirit. The second section of the book, which is entitled, quote, Genesis and Face of the Modern World, unquote, provides a traditionalist investigation of history, beginning from human origins, myth, and prehistory. I here contrasted the modern superstition of evolutionism with the traditional idea of regression and devolution, the idea of a process of alienation from that which transcends the world, a severing of the existing links with the transcendent, leading to the predominance of all that is merely human and, ultimately, material and physical. The aforementioned doctrine of four, which, as I illustrated in the book, is common to both the East and the ancient West, cf. Hesiod, provided the key to objectively define the various stages in the process of descent, for the modern world can be seen to correspond to the final age, the Iron Age of Hesiod, the Kali Yuga or Dark Age of the Hindus, the Wolf Age of the Eddas. I do not wish to dwell on the subject in any detail here. However, it is worth mentioning that, for the purposes of my general historical investigation, I also came to embrace the idea of the gradual collapse of a primordial Hyperborean tradition. Such collapse, I argued, had manifested itself in the clash between a Urano-Viral civilization and the Telluric Lunar civilization of the Mothers, and had been recorded in heroic mythical cycles, with the expressions, quote, hero, unquote, and, quote, generation of heroes, unquote, are to be understood in the Hesiodian sense, as describing specific attempts at restoring the Golden Age. The evidence provided by such cycles proved central to my own analysis. In relation to the Hyperborean tradition, I also referred to the migration of the Nordo-Atlantic or, quote, Aryan, unquote, races, which gave birth to the first Indo-European civilizations. This being the basic framework of Revolt, in a series of chapters I then sought to provide an outline of various civilizations: the Far Eastern, the Hindu, the Native American, the Egyptian, the Hebrew, and the Hellenic. Naturally, in order for my treatment of these civilizations to have proven adequate, a separate book would have been necessary in which, on the basis of a new range of material, I might have developed the general interpretive lines I defined in each of those short chapters of Revolt. I devoted particular attention to the ancient civilization of Rome, which I described as an attempt to impose a Urano-Viral civilization in a world where the opposite kind of civilization had prevailed, almost, therefore, as a, quote, heroic rebirth, unquote. As for Christianity, I continue to regard it as a setback for the Roman and Western tradition. I identified a partial rebirth of the viral tradition in the Holy Roman Empire and in medieval Ghibellinism. Attempts to overcome the rift engendered by the predominance of the alien religion of Christianity in the West, even among those Germanic peoples who had embraced the symbolism of Rome. With the end of the medieval world and the dawn of humanism, the Renaissance, the Reformation, and the rise of nation-states, regressive and destructive elements gained the upper hand. This provided the foundations for the, quote, modern world, unquote, a process which no reaction or attempt at rectification managed to prevent. The centuries that followed witnessed the general secularization of human existence, as well as the affirmation of individualism and rationalism, and, later, of collectivism, materialism, and mechanism, a process culminating in the embrace of influences deriving no longer from what lies beyond man, but from what lies below him. Such elements, I argued in Revolt, have come to determine the form, interests, and sinister power of a global civilization which is speedily progressing towards the end of a great cycle, an event far grander than Spengler's, quote, decline of the West, unquote. In order to illustrate this vast process of degeneration, particularly in its political and social aspects, I referred to the aforementioned law of caste regression. Significantly, other authors had referred to this same law in the years when I was writing Revolt, both simultaneously and independently from one another. On the other hand, the law of caste regression was clearly related to the doctrine of four ages. Such a law is best explained on the basis of an intrinsically valid teaching espoused in a more or less explicit, complete, and regular form among most traditional civilizations. According to such teachings, Human society is structured in four, quote, functional classes, unquote, or castes, which correspond to definite and differentiated ways of being. Each caste possesses its own character, ethics, rights, and duties within the broader framework of tradition. The highest caste is composed of those individuals who embody spiritual authority, the second of the warrior aristocracy, the third of the property-owning bourgeoisie, the fourth of servants. History is clearly marked by the progressive descent of civilization, power, and values from the level of the highest caste to that of the lowest. With the end of those systems based on pure spiritual authority, quote, sacral civilizations, unquote, ruled by, quote, divine kings, unquote, authority fell into the hands of the warrior aristocracy. Here began the cycle of great monarchies, the, quote, divine right, unquote, of the sovereign representing the residual echo of a former sacred dignity. The bourgeois revolution, democracy, capitalism, and industrialism then contributed to transfer power into the hands of the representatives of the third caste, that of the wealthy, such transferal radically altering the character of the civilization and the nature of its interests. In the present day, socialism, Marxism, and communism are foreshadowing, and have already partly brought about the final phase, the advent of the fourth caste, that of servants. Servants, quote, workers, unquote, and proletarians, are here seen to organize themselves in an attempt to gain power and to conquer the world, leaving their imprint on all aspects of life, leading the historical progress of regression to its close. The final chapter of Revolt bears the title, quote, The End of the Cycle, Russia and America, unquote. My remarks here were almost prophetic, particularly considering the fact that I had first published the book in 1934, and that I had already voiced the ideas expressed in this final chapter at an earlier date, as a paper later published in Nova Antologia, or New Anthology. I portrayed the, quote, civilizations, unquote, of communist Russia and of America as the two jaws of a single set of pliers closing upon Europe, seeking to destroy what remained of traditional forms and values, precisely the thing that was destined to happen. I emphasized the traits common to the two opposing world powers, particularly the destructive role they shared. On the other hand, it was clear to me that behind the clash between America and Russia lay the contrast between a bourgeois civilization of the third caste and a civilization of the fourth caste, embodying the final stage in the regressive process. But aside from any secondary, contingent, and episodic use of the theory of caste regression, such a theory served to elucidate world history in a number of other ways. Besides, Marxist historiography has made use of a similar, if less refined and less articulate, scheme. Naturally, it has done so by inversion, by describing what possesses a subversive, regressive, and destructive character as an achievement and a sign of progress. A similar inverted perspective, of course, necessarily represents the, quote, correct, unquote, perspective in the eyes of the human being which existentially corresponds to the fourth caste, and whose advent characterizes the final age, signaling the end of the Hindu, quote, dark age, unquote, and of Hesiod's, quote, iron age, unquote. Clearly, given my understanding of the origins and nature of the modern world, I could not lightheartedly raise a call for reaction. In Revolt, I wrote that, quote, the only individuals who can truly have faith in the future are those who adopt a conditioned perspective, thus manifesting signs for the very ills they wish to fight. By contrast, those individuals who possess the spirit and character that mark each normal traditional civilization, and who are aware of the roots of modern ills, cannot fail to acknowledge the fact that a titanic, non-human endeavor is necessary, not only to return, but merely to draw near to a normal kind of order. Such individuals cannot view the future in the same way as others, unquote. These words of mine applied to the idea of a return to tradition as a broad and universal phenomenon, something other than the privileged prerogative of an elite few removed from the prevailing historical forces. I can envisage no concrete means, however, to accomplish such a return to tradition. Given the overall perspective of Revolt, the book also appeared to be lacking the same faith in Catholicism as a positive point of reference that marked the work of other traditionalist authors. As I previously mentioned, Guinan had argued that the Catholic Church had provided Europe with a traditional order, and that a return to traditional Catholicism, as I already mentioned with regard to the mask and face of contemporary spiritualism, constituted the only means for a rebirth of the West and an overcoming of the crisis of the modern world. Consequently, Guinan had directed a more or less explicit appeal to the representatives of the Catholic tradition. In the letters we privately exchanged, however, Guinan had confessed that while he had felt obliged to launch such an appeal, he had also predicted its failure. As I stated in the conclusion to Revolt, I could not agree with Guinan on this point. Catholicism, I argued, had failed to give proof of any restraining or creative power even in the past, when material and intellectual conditions were far more favorable. Rather, Catholicism was one of the factors which contributed to the dissolution of the West, for Catholicism had caused a disastrous fracture by stripping spirituality of virility and advocating the supremacy of priestly holiness in place of primordial synthesis and centrality, thus favoring the secularization and deconsecration of the world of action and virility. Naturally, revolt did not emphasize those aspects of Catholicism which the mask and face of contemporary spiritualism had praised from a purely doctrinal or esoteric perspective. In my conclusion to the second edition of Revolt, following an evaluation of certain new experiences, I argued that, quote, those individuals who today consider themselves to be men of tradition on the simple grounds of their adherence to Catholicism are stopping midway, for they show no awareness of the series of causes and of the world of origins and absolute values, unquote. From the first edition of Revolt, published in 1934, I implied that all that can be expected is the completion of the present cycle. Nevertheless, in the book, I also discussed those movements that, both in Germany and in Italy, might, in a way, be seen as attempting to externally stem the tide of dissolution by opposing democracy and socialism, Bolshevism, and the United States, an opposition accompanied by a revival of the symbols of the ancient Roman or Nordic tradition. Yet I asked, quote, to what extent can such revivals be seen to express positive values from a higher point of view? To what extent does the use of certain symbols truly evoke a genuine spiritual tradition? Something which transcends what is materially, ethnically, and politically conditioned? And to what extent, instead, does the use of such symbols merely serve as an instrument for political forces operating within the limited framework of the modern idea of nation, forces whose highest ambition is power, understood in the secular, illusionary sense prevalent in this final age, unquote. In Revolt, I repeatedly emphasized the more ambiguous aspects of these political movements, and pointed to the fact that the contemporary world threatens to distort and misdirect the use of symbols and ideas pertaining to a higher order. Again, I was not mistaken in my prediction, and, in the misuse of certain symbols and ideas, I identified one of the aspects of what I termed the, quote, occult war, unquote, a means to discredit and halt the progress of what might serve as a means towards a genuine restoration. When I first published Revolt, I believed it might be possible to reinforce the positive elements present in the aforementioned political movements, and to separate such elements from the more negative and problematic features. If I pursued this contingent goal as best I could, this was partly due to my Kshatriya disposition, which led me to do what had to be done without any concern for either success or failure. The ideas I expressed in Revolt provided the foundation and yardstick for any kind of action. By shunning all compromises, illusions, and pretenses, the book pointed to those values never to be forgotten. I should here mention the nature of my engagement with movements of the right, both in Italy and in Germany, up to the outbreak of the Second World War. First, however, for the sake of chronological order, I wish to briefly discuss another book of mine, which Lotterza published in 1938, under the title of The Mystery of the Grail and the Ghibelline Tradition of Empire. The book developed out of an appendix contained in the first edition of Revolt, and its purpose is to prove the existence in early medieval Europe of a kind of spirituality that can be traced back to the regal strain of the primordial tradition. This spirituality was chiefly expressed symbolically in the literature of chivalry, as well as by means of the figures, myths, and sagas of the, quote, imperial cycle, unquote. My study of this field proved the usefulness of the, quote, traditionalist method, unquote, of inquiry, a method based on integrative comparisons aimed at defining basic values. The ordinary reader today knows about the Grail thanks only to Richard Wagner's Parsifal, which, in its romantic approach, really deforms and twists the whole myth. Equally misleading is the attempt to interpret the mystery of the Grail in Christian terms, for Christian elements only play an accessory, secondary, and concealing role in the saga. In order to grasp the true significance of the myth, it is necessary instead to consider the more immediate points of reference represented by the themes and echoes pertaining to the cycle of King Arthur, which survives in the Celtic and Nordic traditions. The Grail essentially embodies the source of a transcendent and immortalizing power of primordial origin that has been preserved after the, quote, fall, unquote, degeneration and decadence of humanity. Significantly, all sources agree that the guardians of the Grail are not priests, but are knights and warriors. Besides, the very place where the Grail is kept is described not as a temple or church, but as a royal palace or castle. In the book, I argued that the Grail can be seen to possess an initiatory, rather than vaguely mystical, character, that it embodies the mystery of warrior initiation. Most commonly, the sagas emphasize one additional element, the duties deriving from such initiation. The predestined knight, he who has received the calling and has enjoyed a vision of the Grail, or received its boons, or he who has, quote, fought his way, unquote, to the Grail, as described in certain texts, must accomplish his duty of restoring legitimate power, lest he forever be damned. The knight must either allow a prostrate, deceased, wounded, or only apparently living king to regain his strength, or personally assume the regal role, thus restoring a fallen kingdom. The sagas usually attribute this function to the power of the Grail. A significant means to assess the dignity or intentions of the knight is to, quote, ask the question, unquote, the question concerning the purpose of the Grail. In many cases, the posing of this crucial question coincides with the miracle of awakening, of healing, or of restoration. Having determined this much in my study, I then ascribed the essential character of the Grail sagas to a precise historical moment, the imperial Middle Ages in Europe. I thus interpreted the Grail myth as a symbolic expression of the hopes and wishes of the Ghibelline faction to raise, reorganize, and unify the West under a sacred imperium, what certain political theologians have termed the, quote, regal religion of Melchizedek, unquote. In a concealed fashion, the literature of chivalry expressed this Ghibelline drive toward an ideal, a drive shared by the major Swedish rulers, figures often shrouded in myth, as well as by those ascetic and warrior orders of knights which, in a way, embodied the chivalrous ideals of the Grail, in more or less explicit contrast to the opposite spiritual pole of the medieval world, the Church, whose attempts to gain supremacy found an expression in Guelph ideology. One of the major episodes in the opposition between these two poles was the tragic destruction of the Knights Templar. With the end of the Middle Ages, the tradition embodied in the aforementioned sagas disappeared, or rather, it survived underground. In my book, I described those groups which to some extent can be seen as heirs to the myth of the Grail. First and foremost among such groups is that of the Fedeli di Amore, which Dante himself once belonged to, poets whose erotic language often possessed a symbolic and initiatory character, a fact that the work of Luigi Valli, at the time of my inquiry, had contributed to disclose. Such poets belonged to a secret organization, perhaps not unconnected with that of the Templars, of a Ghibelline bent, and decidedly opposed to the Church. The second tradition that preserved the Grail myth was the Hermetic, a tradition which continued to operate well beyond the crisis of the Middle Ages. To these two groups, I should add the Rosicrucians, not to be confused with the various modern sects which have claimed that name for themselves. This mysterious brotherhood advocated a restoration of Europe and the rule of an imperator who would bring all usurpations to an end, following the Treaty of Westphalia, which did away with what little authority the Holy Roman Empire still possessed. The Rosicrucians disappeared once more, staying in the shade. Symbolically, it is said that the Rosicrucians, quote, left, unquote, Europe. This historical overview, which I provided in The Mystery of the Grail, supplemented what I had already written in Revolt concerning the Middle Ages. O.W. Barth published a German translation of the book in 1958, and a second Italian edition was published by Cecchino in 1962. These more recent editions contain some revised material, and a new final chapter on the origins and significance of Freemasonry, as an, quote, inversion of Ghibellinism, unquote. I here described Freemasonry as an organization that had originally possessed an initiatory character, but which had grown increasingly political in nature, ultimately serving as the expression of forces contrary to tradition, and as one of the major secret agents of modern subversion, first in the years leading to the French Revolution, and then more decidedly following the Bourgeois Revolution. The chief point I sought to emphasize was that opposition to the Church and Catholicism, which Ghibellinism had voiced on the basis of an imperial claim to an equally sacred and transcendent form of authority, came to be articulated in accordance with the aforementioned process of inversion, on the basis of Enlightenment ideals of secularization and of the, quote, religion of man, unquote, ideals which sought to free humanity from any kind of authority, dismissed as, quote, tyranny, unquote, and, quote, obscurantism, unquote. More generally, this process of inversion led to an attempt to invest human reason as such with the kind of rights and authority which are superior to ordinary religious dogmas and mythically, quote, revealed, unquote, truths, and which are the exclusive privilege of, quote, enlightened, unquote, individuals, i.e. initiates. Hence, the distortion of the term, quote, enlightenment, unquote, which became synonymous with destructive rational criticism. In such a way, I sought to supplement and clarify what I had previously written. The need for clarification of this kind can be grasped from the fact that, in the aftermath of the Second World War, the term, quote, Ghibelline, unquote, surfaced again in an exceedingly distorted manner as a way to describe the affirmation of the secular and non-denominational state against clericalism. I again denounced the wrongful and equivocal use of the term in my book, Men Among the Ruins. As for the aforementioned involution of Freemasonry, I should mention the fact that, thanks to an extraordinary set of circumstances, While living in Vienna, I came across some precious and rare material on the basis of which I intended to write a book entitled The Secret History of Secret Societies. However, I never got the chance to accomplish this project.